And joining us on Perspectives today is Sarah McCoy. Sarah is the author of The Mapmaker's Children. It's a novel. And basically, it's about Sarah Brown, the vibrant, talented daughter of abolitionist John Brown. She finds her life forever altered when she stumbles across some information that tells her about things that her dad was involved in and what he did. And although reeling from the shocking news she won't ever bear children, she realizes that her artistic talents may be able to help save the lives of slaves fleeing north. However, with Sarah's magic pen and her research, she has brought us back. And 150 years later, Eden Anderson, modern-day woman struggling to conceive a child, kind of almost as some of the same things that Sarah is struggling with. And I'm not going to give anything away, but this is what novelist kind of said on. Sarah, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Louie. It's a pleasure. I have been on the East Coast book touring for the whole month of May, so to be now back home in our Coast City hometown of El Paso is just wonderful. And the weather always brightens my day.
I'm glad you mentioned that because our listeners might be wondering, wait a minute, she lives here in El Paso, so on your author page, you have a lot of information about the fact that, like a lot of people here in El Paso, we're army brats going all over the place. And so no exception with you. And I guess you liked it so much that you decided to marry a soldier. And thank you so much for your service to our country, both of you.
Oh, but you're too kind. And I am proud and honored to be the spouse of a military soldier. I grew up in that. My dad was a career Army soldier. He went to West Point. My brother went to West Point. Then I married an Army guy, and he's stationed at William Beaumont Medical Center. He's an orthopedic surgeon there. So that's what has us here in El Paso. And we're actually only here for one more year, Louie. Just one more year of sunshine. And then we're headed to Chicago. We've already taken a job opportunity there. So then we're out of the military, which makes me so sad to both leave El Paso, which I've come to love the desert and love the Southwest, and the people are just so warm and generous. And people, I go to the East Coast and I trumpet. I trumpet for El Pasoans and for the Southwest culture, and people are shocked. They actually think that people out here might be kind of, you know, cowboy rough. And I say, oh, they are. Yes, we are cowboy rough, but they're also so loving, and they have such a spirit of independence and adventure and so many things that I've come to love over the last 8-9 years of living here. So I have to thank all of your listeners in the local area, and if this gets broadcast further out, just for embracing a Southern East Coast girl who came out here and ended up, you know, buying 12 pairs of boots and loving it.
We're visiting with Sarah McCoy. Sarah is the author of the novel The Mapmaker's Children. And Sarah, as far as the novel that you just came out with, this is your third novel, is it not?
It is. This is my third novel, and I actually wrote a novella in between The Baker's Daughter, which was my second novel, and which is again another contemporary historical hybrid, a dual narrative. And in The Baker's Daughter, the contemporary storyline is actually set here in El Paso. So that was inspired by this. And the library here in El Paso, actually, I just sent them a copy that they're now going to keep in their archives as part of their collection of novels that are set or have to do with El Paso as a city, honoring the city. So that was another great honor to have my book put in that collection's archive. But between The Baker's Daughter and now The Mapmaker's Children, which just came out May 5th, I released last summer a novella.
Now, as we're talking about The Baker's Daughter, you mentioned it, and I think for the benefit of our listeners, because I think you whet their appetite, tell us a little bit more about that novel.
Sure. The Baker's Daughter, it actually was on, it baffled my mind and absolutely just, you know, made my world. The Baker's Daughter actually made the New York Times bestseller list in 2014, And then just made it again in 2015 on Mother's Day Sunday. It was in the New York Times on the list, in the printed edition and everything. So it's continuing to do very, very well. The Baker's Daughter is a story about, again, two women perspective, one in World War II Germany, and it's from the perspective of a German a young woman who is, it's unique in that it's, she is part of the German culture that is in the Nazi fascist country, and yet she is not your stereotypical Nazi. So I wanted to write from that perspective because I lived in Germany for a portion of my childhood, and I knew the people there. They are lovely, wonderful, beautiful, inspiring people, and I didn't feel that that story had ever been told. We'd only heard either the Jewish struggle or we'd heard the Nazi horror. And so I wondered, you know, well, what if you were a citizen and you elected this Hitler monster to power, and then he turned your country into chaos? What would you do if you're afraid of your own countrymen and yet you have to support this country that you're in? Because it is your country. Just like we in the United States, we support our soldiers that are abroad doing things. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know really the horrors that they have to do. And there are many books out there written now that are wonderful books about the plight of soldiers and what they're going through over in Afghanistan and Iraq. My husband was deployed to Afghanistan while I was living here in El Paso, and I stayed here in El Paso while he was overseas. And I would only get little, you know, Skype views into his Spartan tent. And luckily, my husband is a surgeon, so he was there to help soldiers and to treat soldiers that came in from the field. He wasn't actually on the field with a gun. But again, you know, that similarity kind of, it wouldn't let me go. It really weighed heavily on me that there were stories that were untold of people who were forced to do things and make decisions that they might not be proud of or they might not agree with at the time, but should their whole life be judged by that period or that moment or that second of a decision made? So that fascinated me, and that's the historical kind of context. And then coupled with that is contemporary El Paso and a journalist who is looking into some immigration issues that are going on in the city on, you know, decisions of who we keep in and who we say is, you know, you need to get out. You are not qualified to be in our country. Again, a little bit of a mirror there. But what was more interesting to me was, again, that decision-making, that split-second decision of, do I show compassion to my neighbor? Or do I say, these are the rules, this is what I've been told, this is what my government says, this is what the culture says, so I'm going to obey that blindly, even though I might feel differently, even though my heart might say something different. And so that, you know, that sort of harkens back to World War II Germany, where neighbors are being forced to make that decision. Do I obey my government? And do I support my troops? And do I support the propaganda that's being put out there? Or do I say my neighbor, who I've lived with for all my life, might be a Jew, but I love my neighbor. I'm going to show my compassion and protect my neighbor. And if they did that, what were the consequences? Similarly, here in El Paso, what would happen? What would be the consequences if you said, but I love this person, and what do I do? You're torn. So that's the, you know, the storyline between the two. And I won't give anything away because, again, the actual narrative plot is much deeper and richer and more convoluted and mysterious. And I like to take the reader on a journey that makes them put puzzle pieces together. I don't know if you like puzzles, Louie, but I love a good puzzle. So, you know, puzzling the story together to get to the end. And then similarly, I did something of that nature in The Mapmaker's Children, where there is an artifact that is found at the beginning of the book that through the back and forth of Civil War, Underground Railroad, John Brown, abolitionist Virginia, and contemporary West Virginia. The back and forth play allows the reader to, again, connect the chain to put together what the storyline and what the tracks of that story are. So that's how my imagination works. I love reading a book where it forces me to be an active participant in my reading and not just a passive sort of floating on, oh, la la, they get on a boat and they go to Tahiti and they fall in love and then they have a fight and then they all get back together and live happily ever after. If I float on a story like that, at the end, I kind of feel like my brain's turned into cotton candy. I don't know if you know, have that feeling ever, but I like to learn something. If I'm going to invest my time, and if readers, I appreciate how much time, how little time they might have in their life, given that they have families and work and jobs and run to the grocery store and all these things to do, that if they're going to invest and sit down and read something that I've written, a story, I want them to never forget it. I want it to stick, and I want it to be solid and something that makes their, changes them. It changes them. It's a catalyst for something in their present day, even though it's fiction.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Sarah McCoy. Sarah's recent novel is The Mapmaker's Children. And as Sarah's been talking, her novels relate, they're historical novels, and so they take you back and forth, at least the two that she's been talking about, the Civil War and contemporary times, and World War II and contemporary times. And I guess what the listener might want to know, Sarah, is because they're based on these historical figures, that you would have to do a lot of research before you do this. Even though it's fiction, people are going to say, wait a minute, that didn't really happen in the Civil War, or that's not the way it was in Germany, something like that.
Yes, a lot of research. I am not, I wish I could do it faster. I have friends who put out about a book a year, and God bless them. That is, I wish I had that power. But then on book tour, I would say that to these crowds of readers, and then I did an event with a friend who is an author, Karen White, who is a brilliant, brilliant author. She writes a lot of women's contemporary fiction and historical fiction. And I was talking with her, and she said, oh, but you aren't just writing. You are writing stories that are untold, that you have to go and dig them up. So, for instance, in World War II, in The Baker's Daughter, World War II, that perspective of the German citizenship story, I had to really dig into that. I had to go and I had to find, you know, not just my own memories of living there, but interviews and transcripts. And I watched YouTube videos of German people who were still alive, who were giving their story finally. And then other Germans who I knew and met who said that they didn't want to talk about it. I had all these little bits and pieces that I had to go and research. I luckily, like I said, lived in Germany, so that helped very much. And then my husband also, he's an army brat, and his parents were stationed in Germany for about 8 years while we were in college and then 4 years after college. And so we, yes, I've known my husband that long. We used to go back and visit his parents, which were my boyfriend's parents at the time, and then and my in-laws during that station there. And so I had a lot of experiential knowledge of Germany. My husband speaks fluent German. All these things helped greatly in researching, but still it took a long time. And then for The Mapmaker's Children, you know, the Underground Railroad, again, is another secretive association. I mean, it was, when it was used during the Civil War, it was used in a way that they wanted to make sure no one ever found out about it, except for the runaway slaves. And the runaway slaves, if they used it and it worked, they never spoke of it because they wanted other, brethren to use it and for it to work for them instead of for the jig to be up for everyone if they talked about it. So they didn't talk about it either. And if they used it and they didn't make it, of course they didn't talk about it. So it was just this secret thing in American history, and yet something that was so rich in stories. I mean, think about all the people that had used that, both slaves and white men who had maybe used that to help, you know, who had been abolitionists, but also just plantation people who might have used it to help those that they loved and they wanted them to be free. Because there were those Southerners out there who had slaves, who knew that it was wrong, who the culture again around them said that you can't do anything to change this, but who wanted their slaves to be free and to live their lives and loved them. So I dug years. It took me, I started writing this in 2011, and it's just out in 2015. So I think I'm about a 2 to 3 years to get out a book. Because it needs that time to marinate, I need to be able to go to these places. For the Mapmakers Children, I went to West Virginia. Again, I had some ties there. My parents' homestead is in Virginia and about 40 minutes from West Virginia. They're very close. And so I would go home and be forced to go to Harper's Ferry, and, you know, I'm a history nerd anyway, so, oh, I've got to go to this place and walk around all day in the history and, you know, eat the food of the place and take it all in. I've just got to do this. So, I went to Harper's Ferry and the surrounding cities and researched those, took pictures, really got into what the feel, even now and contemporary, is like, because there's a feel in these old places that the what their past has been, it's heavy on it. Harper's Ferry is a very moody place. It feels very haunted, even in the daytime, even in sunshine and in its beauty, it feels the Civil War blood in its ground. You can feel it there. There's a heaviness. And so that mysteriousness went into the book. And then I knew Sarah Brown. That was a big changing point in her life. Her father was killed after the raid on Harper's Ferry. And so after that, I followed her up to Concord, Massachusetts. And so I went to Concord because that's where she went to school and was taught by an abolitionist sort of, again, ties. They had ties to the abolitionist group, even though they didn't put it out there in their school. But their school was certainly very mired in the abolitionist cause. And she went to school there. So I went to her school, and I looked around there, and I asked, give me everything you have on Sarah Brown. And there was just nothing. They said she lived for a little bit with the Alcotts, yeah, Louisa May and Bronson, that family, for a little bit. But then she went and lived at the school because there were just too many girls in one house. They didn't get anything done. So I went and found little bits of her there, and then that wasn't enough, though. I needed more to write this book. And so they said, well, then she moved to California. And that's where she's buried, is out in Sacramento, Red Bluff, California. And I said, well, I guess I'm going to have to go to California. So I went all the way to California. I went to the Saratoga Historical Museum, which is the only place that has any of her artwork anymore. And I took pictures of her artwork. I stood before it. I said, please give me everything. Tell me something about this wonderful woman who history is almost forgotten. And then I went to her grave, and I sat by her grave, and I mean, I feel the need as an author to invest myself deeply in my characters in order to write them with the due respect that they deserve, and especially a character that was real, like Sarah Brown. She was a real woman. She lived, she breathed, she had passions, she had losses. All these things are true. And as you mentioned, Louie, in the books, all the facts are true. I never ever make up or lie. I use the facts because I'm doing stories that are untold, really. I use the facts as sort of my foundation. Like if you're building a house, they're the beams. They're holding this thing up. They're in the concrete. They're the foundation of my books. And then everything that I can't find, all the information I can't find, that's where the story comes in. That's where the craft of writing comes in, and you fill it in with details, and you theorize on how these foundation beams go together to create a house and a life and a history, and you build and build and build brick by brick until you've got this story, this mighty story that you hope will move people and will house people and shelter them and give them a place that they can come to and say, oh, I might be contemporary 2015, but I see such similarities. I see that we are still battling some of these same issues that we did 150 years plus. Why is that? Can we have that conversation now? I mean, 150 years plus, why aren't we having that conversation and facing these issues and being done with them? Why are we still struggling with them today? And so that's sort of the, I hate to use it, but that's the map I work off of, especially for the map makers' children.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Sarah McCoy. Sarah is the author of a novel, The Map Makers' Children, and I guess it's perfect that your book came out in 2015 because this is the anniversary of the end of the Civil War, of the assassination of President Lincoln. Not that it's something to celebrate, but it's something to remember. And one of the things that caught my attention, Sarah, and if you wouldn't mind sharing this with our listeners, is that one of the things that they find is a head, a doll's head, and that supposedly has a lot of secrets. I say supposedly because I don't want anything given away.
When I lived for a time, for 2 years, in Richmond, Virginia, working. And I was working at a chemical company at the time doing public relations, press releases and that sort of thing. I was fresh out of college and I just needed a job to be able to support myself and live. My parents were far away in Detroit, Michigan. And my father was a military guy, so he got stationed up at in Detroit, and I was still in Virginia. And so on my lunch breaks, I'm such a nerd that I would go to the museums in town. And just, I got like a carte blanche pass that allowed me just to go from museum to museum and not, you know, not have to pay because I'd paid for however the whole summer I could go to any of the museums in this one corridor, and I could spend as much time or little time as I wanted. So I would go for lunch breaks. And one of the museums I went to was the Confederacy Museum. And in that museum was a display of this doll called the Nina doll that they said was part of this movement of smuggling dolls during the Civil War. And what they would do is they would put contraband, and that could be anything from spy messages to something as simple as soap, inside of the doll, and then pass it across enemy lines, because they were really trying to cut the South off from everything, be it information about war to just being able to clean themselves. They wanted them cut off. And so they would pass these dolls and use them to get stuff across the lines. And so I found that fascinating way back then, and that was years, I won't tell you how long ago, but it was a long time ago, and that always stuck in my head, though, that was so interesting and fascinating and creepy, because here in this Civil War museum, there's this doll, and really the body, because they're made of material, and material is, and back then particularly, the cotton was not spun the way that we do now. I mean, it was made by hand and by a loom, and these things fell apart very easily. And so there's none of these, the bodies particularly, left. And here, though, but the doll's head was just like right there in front of me. And I thought, that is just creepy. You know, that's just cool and creepy. And so that stayed in my mind. And I went and researched while writing this book more about the theory of these dolls, because again, they have to call it a theory because there isn't any proof, because it was used for purposes that were supposed to be, secretive and covert, and it wasn't supposed to be known that these dolls were being used to do this. And so a lot of the ones that were found that had things in them were destroyed, obviously, by soldiers, and then ones that made it across were then just turned into regular dolls because, you know, once the war was over, why would you need it to be containing anything? Yes. Once you'd gotten the supplies out of it. So it was just really interesting that so few of these existed, and yet there is this theory that they are there and they are real and that they were used. And this Nina doll is one that this family said was absolutely part of this and was donated to the Confederacy Museum. So all of that was just so fascinating to me. And when I sat down to write this and I knew that it was Underground Railroad and I knew that things were being smuggled and I knew that there was an issue of fertility going on in the contemporary world, and with Sarah Brown, who was stricken with dysentery and told that she couldn't bear children very young, I thought, oh, what would just be a smack in a contemporary woman who is struggling with infertility's face and to find a broken doll's head? You know, that's just like, oh, that's just gut-wrenching. Yeah. Oh, what is this in my home that I've, you know, someone has left here from way back in the past? How creepy and awful, and just like, kill me now. So I wanted to use that, and especially with the ties. People ask me, but how? I had readers on book tour this last month say, but I hear all this, but how did you put all that together? And I don't know. It just all came together in my imagination, where it was like that lightning bolt where you just say, aha, there's the key, literally. There's the key right there. Okay, we're going to start with this. Let's do this. And so maybe that's part of the magic of writing. Novel writing, or the craft, or the muse. I don't believe in the muse, the darling muse, because if I did, then she is completely spurning me, because I have to go hunting for her and digging into years of research and working my butt off to find these tidbits. But you know, I don't know how it came together, but it absolutely did. And that doll's head is something that I hope readers never get out of their head. Terrible as that might sound.
Sarah, we're running out of time now, so if you wouldn't mind giving us perhaps a website or somewhere they can go to find out more about your books and you.
Sure, I would love that. My website is www.sarahmccoy.com. Pretty easy. And I am a social media... social. I love being on social media. So I'm on Twitter at Sarah M. McCoy. There's an extra M in between, so Sarah M. McCoy. And then I'm on Facebook. If you come and visit and like my fan page, you can find me there, and I'm very active talking. Any questions that readers ask, I love getting into conversations on Facebook.
We've been visiting with New York Times bestselling author Sarah McCoy. The recent novel is The Mapmaker's Children.